Chapter 13. Cairo, March 31st. The gentleman from Munich was a guest the staff at the Intercontinental Hotel would not soon forget. Mr. Katoubi, the well-oiled chief concierge, had seen many like him, a man perpetually ready to take offense, a small man with a small man's chip balanced precariously on his insignificant shoulder. Indeed, Mr. Katoubi grew to loathe him so intensely that he would wince visibly at the mere sight of him. On the third day, he greeted him with a tense smile and the question, "What is it now, Herr Klemp?" The complaints had begun within minutes of his arrival. Herr Klemp had reserved a non-smoking room, but clearly, he claimed, someone had smoked there very recently, though Mr. Katoubi, who prided himself on a keen sense of smell, was never able to detect even a trace of tobacco on the air. The next room was too close to the swimming pool, the next too close to the nightclub. Finally, Mr. Katoubi gave him, at no additional charge, an upper-floor suite with a terrace overlooking the river, which Herr Klemp pronounced hopelessly adequate. The swimming pool was too warm, his bathroom too cold, he turned up his nose at the breakfast buffet and routinely sent back his food at dinner. The valets ruined the lapels of one of his suits. His massage at the spa had left him with an injured neck. He demanded the maids clean his suite promptly at 8 each morning, and he remained in the room to supervise their work. His cash had been pinched at the Istanbul Hilton, he claimed, and he was not going to let it happen again in Cairo. The moment the maids left, the Do Not Disturb sign would appear on his door latch, where it would remain like a battle flag for the remainder of each day. Mr. Katoubi wished only that he could hang a similar sign on his outpost in the lobby. Each morning at 10, Herr Klemp left the hotel armed with his tourist maps and guidebooks. The hotel drivers took to drawing straws to determine who would have the misfortune of serving as his guide for the day, for each outing seemed more calamitous than the last. The Egyptian Museum, he announced, needed a thorough cleaning. The Citadel he wrote off as a filthy old fort. At the pyramids of Giza, he was nipped by a cantankerous camel. Upon his return from a visit to Coptic Cairo, Mr. Katoubi asked if he enjoyed the Church of St. Barbara.
"Interesting," said Herr Klemp, "but not as beautiful as our churches in Germany."
On his fourth day, Mr. Katoubi was standing at the entrance of the hotel as Herr Klemp came whirling out of the revolving doors into a dust-filled desert wind.
"Good morning, Herr Klemp."
"That is yet to be determined, Mr. Katoubi."
"Does Herr Klemp require a car this morning?"
"No, he does not."
And with that, he set out along the corniche, the tails of his supposedly ruined suit jacket flapping in the breeze like the mudguards of a lorry. Cairo was a city of remarkable resiliency, Mr. Katoubi thought, but even Cairo was no match for a man like Herr Klemp. Gabriel saw something of Europe in the grimy, decaying buildings along Talat Harb Street. Then he remembered reading, in the guidebooks of Herr Klemp, that the 19th-century Egyptian ruler, Khedive Ismail, had conceived of turning Cairo into Paris by the Nile, and had hired some of Europe's finest architects to achieve his dream. Their handiwork was still evident in the neo-Gothic facades, the wrought-iron railings and tall rectangular shuttered windows, though it had been undone by a century's worth of pollution, weather, and neglect. He came to a thunderous traffic circle. A sandaled boy tugged at his coat sleeve and invited him to visit his family's perfume shop.
"Nein, nein,"
said Gabriel in the German of Herr Klemp. But he pushed past the child with a detached air of an Israeli used to fending off hawkers in the alleys of the old city. He followed the circle counterclockwise and turned into Kasr el Nil Street, Cairo's version of the Champs-Élysées. He walked for a time, pausing now and again to gaze into the garish shop windows to see if he was being followed. He left Kasr el Nil and entered a narrow side street. It was impossible to walk on the pavements because they were jammed with parked cars, so he walked in the street like a Cairene. He came to the address shown on the business card Shamron had given him the night before his departure. It was an Italianate building with a facade the color of Nile mud. From a third-floor window came the strains of the BBC's hourly news bulletin theme. A few feet from the entrance, a vendor dispensed paper plates of spaghetti bolognese from an aluminum cart. Next to the vendor, a veiled woman sold limes and loaves of flatbread. Across the cluttered street was a kiosk. Standing in the shade of the little roof, wearing sunglasses and a members-only windbreaker, was a poorly concealed Mukhabarat surveillance man, who watched as Gabriel went inside. It was cool and dark in the foyer. An emaciated Egyptian cat with hollow eyes and enormous ears hissed at him from the shadows, then disappeared through a hole in the wall. A Nubian doorman in a lemon-colored galabia and white turban sat motionless in a wooden chair. He lifted an enormous ebony hand to receive the business card of the man Gabriel wished to see.
"Third floor," he said in English.
Two doors greeted Gabriel on the landing. Next to the door on the right was a brass plaque that read, "David Quinnell, International Press." Gabriel pressed the bell and was promptly admitted into a small antechamber by a Sudanese office boy, whom Gabriel addressed in measured German-accented English.
"Who shall I say is calling?" the Sudanese replied.
"My name is Johannes Klemp."
"Is Mr. Quinnell expecting you?"
"I'm a friend of Rudolf Heller. He'll understand."
"Just a moment. I'll see if Mr. Quinnell can see you now."
The Sudanese disappeared through a set of tall double doors. A moment turned to two, then three. Gabriel wandered to the window and peered into the street. A waiter from the coffee house on the corner was presenting the Mukhabarat man with a glass of tea on a small silver tray. Gabriel heard the Sudanese behind him and turned round.
"Mr. Quinnell will see you now."
The room into which Gabriel was shown had the air of a Roman parlor gone to seed. The wood floor was rough for want of polish. The crown molding was nearly invisible beneath a dense layer of dust and grit. Two of the four walls were given over to bookshelves lined with an impressive collection of works dealing with the history of the Middle East and Islam. The large wood desk was buried beneath piles of yellowed newspapers and unread post. The room was in shadow, except for a trapezoid of harsh sunlight which slanted through the half-open French doors and shone upon a scuffed suede brogue belonging to one David Quinnell. He lowered one half of that morning's El Ahram, the government-run Egyptian daily, and fixed Gabriel in a lugubrious stare. He wore a wrinkled shirt of white Oxford cloth and a tan jacket with epaulets. A lank forelock of gray-blonde hair fell toward a pair of beady, bloodshot eyes. He scratched a carelessly shaved chin and lowered the volume on his radio. Gabriel, even from a distance of several paces, could smell last night's whiskey on his breath.
"Any friend of Rudolf Heller is a friend of mine."
Quinnell's dour expression did not match his jovial tone. Gabriel had the impression he was speaking for an audience of Mukhabarat listeners.
"Herr Heller told me you might be calling. What can I do for you?"
Gabriel placed a photograph on the cluttered desktop, the photo Mahmoud Arwish had given him in Hedera.
"I'm here on holiday," Gabriel said. "Herr Heller suggested I look you up. He said you could show me something of the real Cairo. He said you know more about Egypt than any man alive."
"How kind of Herr Heller. How is he these days?"
"As ever," said Gabriel.
Quinnell, without moving anything but his eyes, looked down at the photograph.
"I'm a bit busy at the moment, but I think I can be of help."
He picked up the photograph and folded it into his newspaper.
"Let's take a walk, shall we? It's best to get out before they turn up the heat."
"Your office is under surveillance?"
They were walking along a narrow, shadowed alleyway lined with shops and vendors. Quinnell paused to admire a bolt of blood-colored Egyptian cotton.
"Sometimes," he said indifferently, "all the hacks are under watch. When one has a security apparatus as large as the Egyptians, it has to be used for something."
"Yes, but you're no ordinary hack."
"True, but they don't know that. To them I'm just a bitter old English shit, trying to scratch a living from the printed word. We've managed to reach something of an accommodation. I've asked them to tidy up my flat when they finish searching it, and They've actually done a rather good job of it.
Quinnell released the cloth and struck out precariously down the alleyway. Gabriel, before setting off after him, glanced over his shoulder and glimpsed members only, listlessly examining an Arabian copper coffee pot. Quinnell's face, by the time Gabriel caught up with him, was already flushed with the late morning heat. He'd been a star once, the roving correspondent for an important London daily, the sort of reporter who parachutes into the world's hot spots and leaves before the story turns dull and the public begins to lose interest. Undone by too much drink and too many women, he'd come to Israel on assignment during the First Intifada and had washed ashore on the Isle of Shamron. Over a private dinner in Tiberias, Shamron had probed and found weakness, a mountain of debt, a secret Jewish past concealed behind a sneering, drunken English exterior. By the time coffee was served on the terrace, Shamron had made his play. It would be a partnership, Shamron had promised, for Shamron regarded as his partner any man he could seduce or blackmail into doing his bidding. Quinnell would use his impressive array of Arab sources to provide Shamron with information and entree. Occasionally he would print a piece of Shamron's black propaganda. In return, Quinnell's equally impressive debt would be quietly retired. He would also receive a few exclusive pieces of news designed to polish his fading reputation, and a publisher would be found for the book he'd always longed to write, though Shamron never revealed how he'd known Quinnell had a manuscript in his drawer. The marriage was consummated, and Quinnell, like Mahmoud Arwish, set himself on a path of betrayal for which the punishment was professional death. As public penance for his private sins, Quinnell had gone over completely to the Arab side. On Fleet Street, he was referred to as the voice of Palestine, apologist for the suicide bombers and Islamofascists.
The imperialist oil-guzzling West and its bastard child Israel had reaped what it had sown, Quinnell often ranted. There will be no security in Piccadilly until there is justice in Palestine.
He was Al Jazeera's favorite Western commentator and much in demand on the Cairo party circuit. Yasser Arafat once called him a courageous man who dares to write the truth, the only man in the West who truly understands the Arab street.
There's a place in Zamalek you should try. It's called Mimi's. Good food, good music.
Quinnell paused and added provocatively,
an interesting crowd. Who's Mimi? Mimi Farrar. She's something of a fixture on the Zamalek social scene. Came here nearly 20 years ago and never left. Everyone knows Mimi, and Mimi knows everyone.
What brought her to Cairo?
The harmonic convergence.
Quinnell, met by Gabriel's blank look, explained.
A bloke named Jose Argaeus wrote a book some time ago called The Mayan Factor. He claimed to have found evidence in the Bible and Aztec and Mayan calendars indicating that August 1987 was a critical juncture in the history of mankind. The world could go one of two ways. It could enter a new age or be destroyed. To avoid destruction, 144,000 people had to gather at so-called power centers around the globe and resonate positive energy. Mimi came to the pyramids along with several thousand other lost souls. She was quite a looker back then. Still is, if you ask me. She married a rich Egyptian and settled on Zamalek. Marriage lasted about a week and a half. When it fell apart, Mimi needed money, so she opened a cafe.
Where is she from?
Quinnell shrugged his shoulders.
Mimi's from everywhere. Mimi's a citizen of the world.
What's the crowd like?
Expats, mainly. A few smart tourists. Arabs with money who still like the West. There's a fellow I see there from time to time. His name is Tony.
Tony, you're sure?
That's what he calls himself. Handsome devil.
Quinnell handed Gabriel the newspaper.
Don't go too early. The place doesn't start to get going until midnight. And watch your step around Mimi. She might be a New Age fruitcake, but she doesn't miss a trick.
Mr. Katoubi booked a table for Herr Johannes Klemp at Mimi's Wine and Jazz Bar for 10 o'clock that evening. At 9, Gabriel came down from his room and, forsaking the taxi stand, set out across the Tahrir Bridge toward Jazeera Island. Reaching the island, he turned right and headed north on the riverfront road, along the fringe of the old sporting club where British colonialists had played cricket and drunk gin while the empire collapsed around them. A string of luxury high-rise apartment buildings appeared on his left, the first evidence he had entered the most sought-after address in Cairo. Foreigners lived here, so did wealthy Egyptians who took their cues not from Islam, but from the trendsetters of New York and London. It was relatively clean in Zamalek, and the incessant noise of Cairo was just a discontented grumble from the other bank of the river. One could sip cappuccinos in the coffee bars and speak French in the exclusive boutiques. It was an oasis, a place where the rich could pretend they were not surrounded by a sea of unimaginable poverty. Mimi's occupied the ground floor of an old house just off July 26th Street. The Art Deco neon sign was in English, as was the entirely vegetarian menu, which was displayed under glass and framed in hand-painted wood. Next to the menu hung a large poster with a photograph of the evening's featured entertainment, five young men with silk scarves and much jewelry. It was the sort of place Gabriel would normally enter only at gunpoint. Herr Klemp squared his shoulders and went inside. He was greeted by a dark-skinned woman dressed in orange satin pajamas and a matching head wrap. She spoke to him in English, and he responded in kind. Hearing the name Johannes Klemp, she smiled warily, as though she had been forewarned by Mr. Katoubi to expect the worst, and led him to a table near the bandstand. It was a low, arabesque piece, surrounded by brightly colored, overstuffed lounge chairs. Gabriel had the distinct impression he would not be spending the evening alone. His fears were realized 20 minutes later when he was joined by three Arabs. They ordered champagne and ignored the morose-looking German with whom they were sharing a table. It was a pleasant room, long and oval-shaped, with rough whitewashed plaster walls and swathes of silk hanging from the high ceiling. The air smelled of eastern spice and sandalwood incense, and vaguely of hashish. Along the edge of the room, and barely visible in the subdued light, were several domed alcoves, where patrons could eat and drink in relative privacy. Gabriel picked at a plate of Arab appetizers and looked in vain for anyone resembling the man in the photograph. True to Quinnell's word, the music didn't start till 11. The first act was a Peruvian who wore a sarong and played Incan-influenced New Age pieces on a nylon-stringed guitar. Between numbers, he told fables of the high Andes in nearly impenetrable English. At midnight came the featured entertainers of the evening, a group of Moroccans who played atonal Arab jazz in keys and rhythms no Western ear could comprehend. The three Arabs paid no attention to the music and spent the evening in liquor-lubricated conversation. Herr Klemp smiled and applauded in appreciation of admirable solos, yet Gabriel heard none of it, for all his attention was focused on the woman holding court at the end of the bar.
"She was quite a looker back then," Quinnell had said. "Still is, if you ask me."
She wore white capri pants and a satin blouse of pale blue tied at her slender waist. Viewed from behind, she might have been mistaken for a girl in her 20s. Only when she turned, revealing the wrinkles around her eyes and the streak of gray in her dark hair, did one realize she was a middle-aged woman. She wore bangles on her wrists and a large silver pendant around her long neck. Her skin was olive-complected, and her eyes nearly black. She greeted everyone in the same manner, with a kiss on each cheek and a whispered confidence. Gabriel had seen many versions of her before, the woman who moves from villa to villa and party to party, who stays permanently tanned and permanently thin and cannot be bothered with a husband or children. Gabriel wondered what on earth she was doing in Cairo. The Moroccan quintet took a break and threatened to return in 10 minutes. The house lights came up slightly, as did the volume of the conversation. The woman detached herself from the bar and began working the room, moving effortlessly from table to table, alcove to alcove, as a butterfly floats from one flower to the next. Old acquaintances she greeted with kisses and a whisper. New friends were treated to a long handshake. She spoke to them in Arabic and English, in Italian and French, in Spanish and respectable German. She accepted compliments like a woman used to receiving them, and left no turbulence in her wake. For the men, she was an object of cautious desire. For the women, admiration. She arrived at the table of Herr Klemp as the band was filing back onto the stage for a second set. He stood, and, bowing slightly at the waist, accepted her proffered hand. Her grip was firm, her skin cool and dry. Releasing his hand, she pushed a stray lock of hair from her face and regarded him playfully with her brown eyes. Had he not seen her give the same look to every other man in the room, he might have assumed she was flirting with him.
"I'm so glad you could join us this evening," she spoke to him in English, and in the confiding tone of a hostess who had thrown a small dinner party. "I hope you're enjoying the music. Aren't they wonderful? I'm Mimi, by the way."
And with that, she was gone. Gabriel turned his gaze toward the stage, but in his mind he was back in Natan Hafi's underground lair, listening to the recordings of the mysterious woman with a friend named Tony.
"I'm Mimi, by the way."
"No, you're not," thought Gabriel. "You're Madeleine, and Alexandra, and Lunetta. You're the little moon." Next morning, Mr. Katoubi was standing at his post in the lobby when the telephone purred. He glanced at the caller ID and exhaled heavily. Then he lifted the receiver slowly, a sapper defusing a bomb, and brought it to his ear.
"Good morning, Herr Klemp."
"It is indeed, Mr. Katoubi."
"Do you require assistance with your bags?"
"No assistance required, Katoubi. Change in plans. I've decided to extend my stay. I'm enchanted by this place."
"How fortunate for us," Mr. Katoubi said icily. "For how many additional nights will you require your room?"
"To be determined, Katoubi. Stay tuned for further updates."
"Staying tuned, Herr Klemp."
Chapter 14. Cairo.
"I never signed up for anything like this," Quinnell said gloomily.
It was after midnight. They were in Quinnell's tired little Fiat. Across the Nile, central Cairo stirred restlessly, but Zamalek at that hour was quiet. It had taken 2 hours to get there. Gabriel was certain no one had followed them.
"You're sure about the flat number?"
"I've been inside," Quinnell said. "Not in the capacity I'd hoped, mind you. Just one of Mimi's parties. She lives in flat A. Everyone knows Mimi's address."
"You're sure she doesn't have a dog?"
"Just an Angora cat with a weight problem. I'm sure a man who claims to be a friend of the great Herr Heller will have no problem dealing with an obese cat. I, on the other hand, have to contend with the 7-foot Nubian doorman. How did that happen?"
"You're one of the world's finest journalists, Quinnell. Surely you can deceive a doorman."
"True, but this isn't exactly journalism."
"Think of it as an English schoolboy prank. Tell him the car's died. Tell him you need help. Give him money. 5 minutes, not a minute longer. Understood?"
Quinnell nodded.
"And if your friend from the Mukhabarat shows up,"
Gabriel asked,
"what's the signal?"
"2 short horn blasts, followed by a long one."
Gabriel climbed out of the car, crossed the street, and descended a flight of stone steps leading to a quay along the waterfront. He paused for a moment to watch the graceful, angular sail of a felucca gliding slowly upriver. Then he turned and walked south, Herr Klemp's smart leather satchel hanging from his right shoulder. After a few paces, the upper floors of Mimi's apartment house came into view above the rise. An old Zamalek building, whitewashed, with large terraces overlooking the river. 100 yards beyond the building, another flight of steps rose toward the street. Gabriel, before mounting them, looked down the river to see if he had been followed, but found the quay deserted. He climbed the steps and crossed the street, then made his way to the entrance of a darkened alleyway that ran along the back of the apartment houses. Had it been his first time there, he might not have found his destination. But he had walked the alley in daylight and knew with certainty that 130 normal paces would bring him to the service entrance of Mimi Farrar's building.
Painted on the dented metal door in Arabic script were the words, "Do not enter." Gabriel glanced at his wristwatch. The walk from the car, as expected, had taken 4 minutes and 30 seconds. He tried the latch and found that it was locked, as it had been earlier that day. He removed the pair of thin metal tools from the side pocket of the satchel and crouched so that the latch was at eye level. Within 15 seconds, the lock had surrendered. He eased open the door and looked inside. A short, cement-floored corridor stretched before him. At the other end was a half-open door, which gave onto the lobby. Gabriel stole forward and concealed himself behind the second door. From the other side, he could hear the voice of David Quinnell offering the Nubian doorman £20 to push his disabled car from the street. When the conversation fell silent, Gabriel peered around the edge of the door just in time to see the robes of the Nubian flowing into the darkness. He entered the lobby and paused at the mailboxes. The box for apartment 6A bore the label M. Farrar. He mounted the staircase and climbed up to the sixth floor. The door was flanked by a pair of potted palms. Gabriel pressed his ear to the wood and heard no sound from within. From his pocket, he removed a device disguised as an electric razor and ran it around the edge of the door. A small light glowed green, which meant the device had detected no evidence of an electronic security system. Gabriel slipped the apparatus back into his pocket and inserted his old-fashioned lockpick into the keyhole. Just as he began to work, he heard female voices filtering up the stairwell from below. He proceeded calmly, his fingertips registering subtle changes in tension and torque, while another part of his mind turned over the possibilities. The building had 11 floors. The chances were slightly better than even that the women on the stairs were heading for the 6th floor or higher. He had 2 options. Abandon his work for the moment and head down the stairs toward the lobby, or seek refuge on an upper floor. Both plans had potential pitfalls. The women might find the presence of a strange foreigner in the building suspicious, and if they happened to live on the top floor, he might find himself trapped with no route of escape. He decided to keep working. He thought of the drills he'd done at the academy, of Shamron standing over his shoulder, exhorting him to work as though his life and the lives of his team depended on it. He could hear the clatter of their high heels now, and when one of the women squealed with laughter, his heart gave a sideways lurch. When finally the last pin gave way, Gabriel put his hand on the latch and felt the gratifying sensation of movement. He pushed open the door and slipped inside, then closed it again just as the women were reaching the landing. He leaned his back against the door and, with only his lockpick as a weapon, held his breath as they passed in laughter. For an instant, he hated them for their frivolity. He locked the door. From the satchel he removed a cigar-sized maglite and shone the narrow beam about the flat. He was standing in a small entrance hall, beyond which was the sitting room. Cool and white, with low, comfortable furniture and an abundance of colorful pillows and throws. It reminded Gabriel vaguely of Mimi's nightclub. He moved slowly forward, but stopped suddenly when the light fell upon a pair of neon yellow eyes. Mimi's fat cat lay curled atop an ottoman. It looked at Gabriel without interest, then rested its chin on its paws and closed its eyes. He had a list of targets, organized in order of importance. Highest priority were Mimi's telephones. He found the first in the sitting room, resting atop an end table. The second he located on the nightstand in the bedroom. The third in the room she used as an office. To each, he attached a miniature device known in the lexicon of the office as a glass, a transmitter that would provide coverage of both the telephone and the room around it. With a range of roughly 1,000 yards, it would permit Gabriel to use his suite at the Intercontinental as a listening post. In the office, he also found the second item on his target list, Mimi's computer. He sat down, powered on the computer, and inserted a compact disc into the drive. The software engaged automatically and began collecting the data stored on the hard drive, mailboxes, documents, photographs, even audio and video files. While the files downloaded, Gabriel had a look round the rest of the office. He He leafed through a stack of post, opened desk drawers, glanced at the files. The absence of time permitted nothing more than a cursory examination of the items, and Gabriel found nothing that leapt to his attention. He checked the progress of the download, then stood up and played the beam of the maglight around the walls. One was covered with several framed photographs. Most showed Mimi with other beautiful people. In one, he saw a younger version of Mimi, her shoulders wrapped in a kafia. In the background stood the pyramids of Giza. They, like her face, were washed in sienna by the sinking sun. Mimi, New Age idealist, trying to save the world from destruction through the power of positive thinking. A second photograph caught Gabriel's eye. Mimi, her head resting on a lavender-colored pillow, staring directly into the camera lens. Her cheek was pressed to the face of a man feigning sleep. A hat was pulled down over his eyes so that only his nose, mouth, and chin were visible. Enough of the face, Gabriel knew, for the experts in facial recognition to make a positive identification. He produced a small digital camera from Herr Klemp's satchel and took a photograph of the photograph. He walked back to the desk and saw that the download was complete. He removed the disk from the drive and shut down the computer. Then he glanced at his wristwatch. He'd been inside the flat for 7 minutes, 2 minutes longer than he'd planned. He dropped the disk into his satchel, then went to the front door, pausing for a moment to make certain the landing was empty before letting himself out. The stairwell was deserted, as was the lobby, except for the Nubian doorman, who wished Gabriel a pleasant evening as he slipped past and went into the street. Quinnell, a picture of indifference, was sitting on the hood of his car smoking a cigarette. Like a good professional, he kept his eyes to the ground as Gabriel turned to the left and started walking toward the Tahrir Bridge. Next morning, Herr Klemp fell ill. Mr. Katoubi, after receiving a disagreeably detailed description of the symptoms, diagnosed the disorder as bacterial in nature and predicted the onslaught would be violent but brief.
"Cairo has betrayed me," Herr Klemp complained. "I was seduced by her, and she repaid my affection with vengeance."
Mr. Katoubi's forecast of a swift recovery proved erroneous. The storm in Herr Klemp's bowels raged on for many days and nights. Doctors were summoned, medication was prescribed, but nothing seemed to work. Mr. Katoubi set aside his hard feelings for Herr Klemp and personally assumed responsibility for his care. He prescribed a time-proven potion of boiled potatoes sprinkled with lemon juice and salt, and delivered the concoction himself 3 times daily. Illness softened Herr Klemp's demeanor. He was pleasant to Mr. Katoubi, and even apologetic to the maids who had to clean his appalling bathroom. Sometimes, when Mr. Katoubi entered the room, he would find Herr Klemp seated in the armchair next to the window, gazing wearily toward the river. He spent most of his time, though, stretched listlessly on the bed. To relieve the boredom of captivity, he listened to music and German-language news on his shortwave radio, on tiny earphones, so as not to disturb the other guests. Mr. Katoubi found himself missing the old Johannes Klemp. Sometimes he would look up from his outpost in the lobby and long to see the cantankerous German pounding across the marble floor, with his coattails flapping and his jaw steeled for confrontation. One morning, a week to the day after Herr Klemp had first taken ill, Mr. Katoubi knocked on Herr Klemp's door and was surprised by the vigorous voice that ordered him to come in. He slipped his passkey into the lock and entered. Herr Klemp was packing his bags.
"The storm has ended, Katoubi."
"Are you certain?"
"As certain as one can be in a situation like this." "I'm sorry Cairo treated you so badly, Herr Klemp. I suppose the decision to extend your stay turned out to be a mistake."
"Perhaps, Katoubi.
But then I've never been one to dwell on the past, and neither should you."
"It's the Arab disease, Herr Klemp."
"I suffer from no such affliction, Katoubi."
Herr Klemp placed his shortwave radio into his bag and closed the zipper.
"Tomorrow is another day."
It was raining in Frankfurt that evening. The Lufthansa pilot had made that abundantly clear. He'd spoken of the rain while they were still on the ground in Cairo, and twice during the flight he'd provided them tedious updates. Gabriel had latched onto the pilot's plodding voice, for it had given him something to do besides stare at his wristwatch and calculate the hours until Khaled's next massacre of the innocents. As they neared Frankfurt, he leaned his head against the glass and looked out, hoping to glimpse the first lights of the South German plane. But instead he saw only blackness. The jetliner plunged into the cloud, and his window was awash with horizontal streaks of rainwater, and Gabriel, in the scampering droplets, saw Khaled's teams moving into position for their next strike. Then, suddenly, the runway appeared, a sheet of polished black marble rising slowly to receive them, and they were down. In the terminal, he went to a telephone kiosk and dialed the number for a freight forwarding company in Brussels. He identified himself as Stevens, one of his many telephone names, and asked to speak to a Mr. Parsons. He heard a series of clicks and hums, then a female voice, distant and with a slight echo. The girl, Gabriel knew, was at that moment seated on the operations control desk at King Saul Boulevard.
"What do you require?"
she asked. "Voice identification."
"You have a recording?"
"Yes."
"Quality?"
Gabriel, using Hebrew terms no listener could comprehend, tersely relayed to the girl the technical means with which he had captured and recorded the subject's voice.
"Play the recording, please."
Gabriel pressed play and held his recorder up to the mouthpiece of the receiver. Male voice, perfect French.
"It's me. Give me a ring when you have a chance. Nothing urgent. Ciao."
He lowered the tape player and placed the receiver against his ear.
"No match on file,"
said the woman.
"Compare to unidentified voice print 698D.
"Stand by."
Then a moment later.
"It's a match."
"I need a telephone number ID."
Gabriel located the second intercept, then pressed play and held the recorder up to the phone again. It was the sound of Mimi Farrar making an international call from the phone in her office. When the last number had been dialed, Gabriel pressed pause. The woman at the other end of the line recited the number.
00339154678.
Gabriel knew that 33 was the country code for France, and that 91 was the city code for Marseille.
"Run it," he said.
"Stand by."
2 minutes later, the woman said,
"The telephone is registered to a Monsieur Paul Véran, 56 Boulevard Saint-Rémy, Marseille."
"I need another voice identification."
"Quality?"
"Same as before."
"Play the recording."
Gabriel pressed play, but this time the voice was drowned out by the sound of a security announcement in German blaring from the speaker above his head.
"Achtung, Achtung!"
When it was over, he pressed play again. This time, the voice, a woman's, was clearly audible.
"It's me. Where are you? Call me when you can. Much love."
Stop.
"No match on file."
"Compare to unidentified voice print 572B.
"Stand by."
Then.
"It's a match."
"Please note, subject goes by the name Mimi Farrar. Her address is 24 Brazil Street, apartment 6A, Cairo."
"I've added it to the file. Elapsed time of this call, 4 minutes, 32 seconds. Anything else?"
"I need you to pass a message to Ezekiel."
Ezekiel was the telephone code word for the operations directorate.
"Message?"
"Our friend is spending time in Marseille at the address you gave me."
"Number 56, Boulevard Saint-Rémy?"
"That's right," Gabriel said. "I need instructions from Ezekiel on where to proceed."
"You're calling from Frankfurt Airport?"
"Yes."
"I'm terminating this call. Move to another location and call back in 5 minutes. I'll have instructions for you then."
Gabriel hung up the phone. He went to a newsstand, bought a German magazine, then walked a short distance through the terminal to another kiosk of telephones. Same number, same patter, same girl in Tel Aviv.
"Ezekiel wants you to go to Rome."
"Rome? Why Rome?"
"You know I can't answer that."
It was no matter. Gabriel knew the answer.
"Where should I go?"
"The apartment near the Piazza di Spagna. Do you know it?"
Gabriel did. It was a lovely, safe flat, at the top of the Spanish Steps, not far from the Church of the Trinità dei Monti.
"There's a flight from Frankfurt to Rome in 2 hours. We're booking a seat for you.
Do you want my frequent flyer number?
What?
Never mind.
Have a safe trip,
said the girl, and the line went dead. Part 3. The Gare de Lyon. Chapter 15. Marseille. For the second time in 10 days, Paul Martineau made the drive from Aix-en-Provence to Marseille. Once again, he entered the coffee house on the small street off the Rue des Convalescents and climbed the narrow stairs to the flat on the first floor. And once again, he was greeted on the landing by the gowned figure who spoke to him quietly in Arabic. They sat, propped on silk pillows, on the floor of the tiny living room. The man slowly loaded hashish into a hubble bubble and touched a lighted match to the bowl. In Marseille, he was known as Hakim El Bakri, a recent immigrant from Algiers. Martineau knew him by another name, Abu Sadiq. Martineau did not refer to him by that name, just as Abu Sadiq did not call Martineau by the name he'd been given by his real father. Abu Sadiq drew heavily on the mouthpiece of the pipe, then inclined it in Martineau's direction. Martineau took a long pull at the hashish and allowed the smoke to drift out his nostrils. Then he finished the last of his coffee. A veiled woman took away his empty cup and offered him another. When Martineau shook his head, the woman slipped silently from the room. He closed his eyes as a wave of pleasure washed over his body. The Arab way, he thought, a bit of smoke, a cup of sweet coffee, the subservience of a woman who knew her place in life. Though he had been raised a proper Frenchman, it was Arab blood that flowed in his veins, and Arabic that felt most comfortable on his tongue. The poet's language, the language of conquest and suffering. There were times when the separation from his people was almost too painful to bear. In Provence, he was surrounded by people like himself, yet he could not touch them. It was as if he had been condemned to wander among them, as a damned spirit drifts among the living. Only here, in Abu Sadiq's tiny flat, could he behave as the man he truly was. Abu Sadiq understood this, which was why he seemed in no hurry to get around to business. He loaded more hashish into the water pipe and struck another match. Martineau took another draw from the pipe, this one deeper than the last, and held the smoke until it seemed his lungs might burst. Now his mind was floating. He saw Palestine not with his own eyes, but as it had been described to him by those who had actually seen it. Martineau, like his father, had never set foot there. Lemon trees and olive groves, that's what he imagined. Sweet springs and goats pulling on the tan hills of the Galilee. A bit like Provence, he thought, before the arrival of the Greeks. The image disintegrated, and he found himself wandering across a landscape of Celtic and Roman ruins. He came to a village on the coastal plain of Palestine. Beit Said, they had called it. Now there was nothing but a footprint in the dusty soil. Martineau, in his hallucination, fell to his knees and with his spade clawed at the earth. It surrendered nothing, no tools or pottery, no coins or human remains. It was as if the people had simply vanished. He forced open his eyes. The vision dissipated. His mission would soon be over. The murders of his father and grandfather would be avenged, his birthright fulfilled. Martineau was confident he would not spend his final days as a Frenchman in Provence, but as an Arab in Palestine. His people, lost and scattered, would be returned to the land, and Beit Said would rise once more from its grave. The days of the Jews were numbered. They would leave, like all those who had come to Palestine before them, the Greeks and Romans, the Persians and the Assyrians, the Turks and the British. One day soon, Martineau was convinced he would be searching for artifacts amid the ruins of a Jewish settlement. Abu Sadiq was pulling at his shirt sleeve and calling him by his real name. Martineau turned his head slowly and fixed Abu Sadiq in a heavy-lidded gaze. "Call me Martineau," he said in French. "I'm Paul Martineau, Dr. Paul Martineau." "You were far away for a moment." "I was in Palestine," Martineau murmured, his speech heavy with the drug. "Beit Said." "We'll all be there soon,"
Abu Sadiq said. Martineau treated himself to a smile, not one of arrogance, but of quiet confidence. Buenos Aires, Istanbul, Rome, three attacks, each flawlessly planned and executed. The teams had delivered their explosives to the target and had vanished without a trace. In each operation, Martineau had concealed himself with archaeological work and had operated through a cutout. Abu Sadiq was handling the Paris operation. Martineau had conceived and planned it. Abu Sadiq, from his coffee house in the Quartier Belsens, moved the chess pieces at Martineau's command. When it was over, Abu Sadiq would suffer the same fate as all those Martineau had used. He had learned from the mistakes of his ancestors. He would never allow himself to be undone by an Arab traitor. Abu Sadiq offered Martineau the pipe. Martineau lifted his hand in surrender. Then, with a slow nod of his head, he instructed Abu Sadiq to get on with the final briefing. For the next half hour, Martineau remained silent while Abu Sadiq spoke. The locations of the teams, the addresses in Paris where the suitcase bombs were being assembled, the emotional state of the three shahids. Abu Sadiq stopped talking while the veiled woman poured more coffee. When she was gone again, Abu Sadiq mentioned that the last member of the team would arrive in Marseille in 2 days' time. "She wants to see you," Abu Sadiq said, "before the operation." Martineau shook his head. He knew the girl. They had been lovers once. And he knew why she wanted to see him. It was better they not spend time together now, otherwise Martineau might have second thoughts about what he had planned for her. "We stay to the original plan," he said. "Where do I meet her?" "The Internet Café overlooking the harbor. Do you know it?" Martineau did. "She'll be there at 12:30. Just then, from the minaret of a mosque up the street, the muezzin summoned the faithful to prayer. Martineau closed his eyes as the familiar words washed over him. "God is most great. I testify that there is no God but God. I testify that Muhammad is the prophet of God. Come to prayer. Come to success. God is most great. There is no God but God." Martineau, when the call to prayer had ended, stood and prepared to take his leave. "Where's Hadawi?" he asked.
"Zurich. He's something of a liability, wouldn't you say?"
Abu Sadiq nodded.
"Should I move him?"
"No," said Martineau. "Just kill him." Martineau's head had cleared by the time he reached the Place de la Préfecture. How different things were on this side of Marseille, he thought. The streets were cleaner, the shops more plentiful. Martineau, the archaeologist, could not help but reflect on the nature of the two worlds that existed side by side in this ancient city. One was focused on devotion, the other on consumption. One had many children, the other found children to be a financial burden. The French, Martineau knew, would soon be a minority in their own country, colons in their own land. Someday soon, a century, perhaps a bit longer, France would be a Muslim country. He turned into the Boulevard Saint-Remy, tree-lined and split by a Péage parking lot in the median. The street rose at a slight pitch toward a small green park with a view of the old port. The buildings on each side were fashioned of stately gray stone and uniform in height. Iron bars covered the ground floor windows. Many of the buildings contained professional offices, lawyers, doctors, estate agents. And farther up the street, there were a couple of banks and a large interior design store. At the base of the street, on the edge of the Place de la Préfecture, were a pair of opposing kiosks, one selling newspapers, the other sandwiches. During the day, there was a small market in the street, but now that it was dusk, the vendors had packed up their cheese and fresh vegetables and gone home. The building at number 56 was residential only. The foyer was clean, the stairway wide, with a wood banister and a new runner. The flat was empty, except for a single white couch and a telephone on the floor. Martineau bent down, lifted the receiver, and dialed a number. An answering machine, just as he'd expected.
"I'm in Marseille. Call me when you have a chance."
He hung up the phone, then sat on the couch. He felt the pressure of his gun pushing into the small of his back. He leaned forward and drew it from the waist of his jeans. A Stecken 9mm. His father's gun. For many years after his father's death in Paris, the weapon had gathered dust in a police lockup, evidence for a trial that would never take place. An agent of French intelligence spirited the gun to Tunis in 1985 and made a gift of it to Arafat. Arafat had given it to Martineau. The telephone rang. Martineau answered.
Monsieur Varin?
Mimi, my love, Martineau said. So good to hear the sound of your voice.